many who flee because they are facing situations that undercut their dignity arrive in situations that undercut their dignity in different ways. Discrimination, to racism, to poverty, to legal persecution or lack of rights.
War, natural disaster, and many other factors create displacement of people who live all throughout the world. In Syria, the last 20 years have been particularly trying. This is Random Acts of Knowledge, presented by Heartland Community College. I'm your host, Steve Fast. Today we talk to a political science professor from Northwestern University who over the years interviewed more than 400 refugees from Syria. She shares their stories in a series of books and talks to us today about the impact that displacement has on Syrians who have found themselves forced to relocate to other places beyond their home.
My name is Wendy Perlman. I'm a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where I focus on Middle East politics.
You've been gathering stories of Syrian refugees for decades. This is a very big question. How has that story changed over time?
Yeah, it's changed a lot. So I began collecting stories of Syrians who were displaced from the country in 2012, which was 1 year after there began in 2011 an uprising against the authoritarian Assad regime. And when I first began, the truth is I wasn't even interested in people as refugees. I was mostly interested in the story of the Syrian uprising, and especially how people came to protest and how they mustered the courage to protest despite enormous risks, how people were really risking their lives to go out and protest. And because I essentially was too scared to go inside Syria and start talking to people about politics and protest, I began interviewing Syrians who had left the country. So in the beginning, I wasn't even interested in them as refugees. I wanted to access stories of protest. And the truth is, when I began, most people didn't even see themselves as refugees. They thought they had fled temporarily. There was bombing and violence. They had to get out of their hometowns to seek shelter. But many expected to go back any day. They thought they were going to wake up and get the notice that the regime had fallen and they could go back home. And then as years passed and I kept doing interviews and going back to the Middle East and then eventually going to Europe, where many Syrians were able to find and build new lives, people slowly faced a reality in which it would be unlikely that they would go home and had no choice but to build new lives and maybe move further and further away wherever they could find rights and opportunities and possibilities for themselves and their kids. So that displacement that began as temporary seemed more and more to become permanent. And then shockingly, in December 2024, the regime fell. Rebel groups managed to overthrow the regime in a shocking 11-day lightning offensive. The country is now going through a political transition. Some refugees are going back. Others are visiting for the first time. And everyone is wrapping their heads around this totally transformed reality. So I have been so privileged to be able to be along for this journey in which at first people didn't even think they would be permanently displaced. Then in this heavy middle phase, many came to think that their displacement would be forever and they'd never go back and see their home country. And now are coping with the reality in which they could go back if they want. And some of the people I've talked to along the way have decided to move back. So it's been a tremendous journey with dramatic transformations over time.
Well, during the time you've been doing this and prior to that, through, as you said, recently with the overthrow of the regime, all these things have happened. Bashar al-Assad assumes power. You know, the Assad regime had existed, but then he assumes power and there is a change in even how he approaches that style of governance. Mm-hmm. There's the Arab Spring. There's civil war. There's a chemical weapons attack that tests U.S. and allied resolve and how the rest of the world approaches Syria. ISIS gains a foothold. Russia gets involved. Massive earthquake in 2023. And then, of course, Assad deposed, flees the country. There's still sectarian violence, and they're trying to figure out how the country, the future of the country, with essentially the military rebellion. So all of these things, any individual one of these things would create a condition where people would be displaced. But so many of these things over the years has created a crisis for these Syrians, but also for the region. Is the Syrian story, in a way, almost unique in that there are all these different incidences that have happened over a relatively short period of time, historically speaking.
Yeah, there have been some pretty dramatic events in an intense amount of time. So you can imagine that your average Syrian individual, you know, has whiplash in even making sense of one reality to another. And it's a tremendous amount to absorb intellectually and emotionally, no less worry about all the everyday problems and challenges people have of finding food and getting their kids in school and keeping safe. So it's a tremendous amount. I mean, I think that probably every country and situation is unique in some ways, but there are some that's shared. So this particular sequence that you outlined so beautifully of the sort of one blow after another, I don't know of another country that's experienced that particular sequence. But for example, even in this talk that I just gave, there was a young man in the audience who came up afterwards and said, you know, he's from Honduras, and he identified so much with the kinds of things that I shared in the talk, that experience of having to flee home, the experience of missing that home, the experience of trying to make your way in a new place where locals might say, why are you here and stealing our jobs, and can't even wrap their heads around and understand the kinds of things that you've left and being between places and how difficult that is, and the challenges on multiple different fronts. So the situation in Honduras is extremely different than the situation in Syria, but the kinds of challenges of being displaced, the challenges of war, the way that the people endure so much, but the way they also grow and can attain such wisdom and insight and understanding of the human condition because of what they've been forced to endure can be shared and be a point of commonality across people who've experienced war, experienced forced displacement. Part of the message of the work I've done is that people who have not experienced war or not experienced displacement have so much to learn from those who have. And that wisdom, or the source of wisdom, can be shared even if the circumstances that produce that wisdom are quite distinct.
You've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of folks that have been displaced. And all of these situations, whether it's from violence or from the threat of violence, they're all traumatic. When you speak with these folks, how much of that trauma do you see affect how they talk about their situation? Or do they just see it that way or not see it that way?
Yeah, it really varies across people. Everyone has experienced some degree of trauma. And here it's really important to emphasize, it's not just the Syrians who are forced to flee who have trauma. The Syrians who remained and didn't leave also have a tremendous amount of trauma. And sometimes it's their voices that we haven't heard as much as it's important to hear refugee voices. Sometimes their voices are easier to access because they're with us and among us in communities around the world. And something I'm trying to understand now is the experience of Syrians who didn't leave and what they've endured. But everyone has trauma, for sure. In the Syrian context, simply having the authoritarian regime, the kind of violence that the state used against its own citizens, the threat and reality of political imprisonment, there are an estimated some 180,000 Syrians were arrested or detained and disappeared. And their families don't even know if they're alive or dead. And I know families I've talked to personally who live every day hoping that there's going to be a knock on their door and their loved one will return. That is itself a tremendous amount of trauma, no less the people who were injured, who were tortured, who experienced bombing. It's unfathomable. And when I speak to people, there's a whole range of where people are in coping with that trauma. Some people are able to compartmentalize and speak and it's not palpable in the conversation. Other people, it's quite vividly there. You can see in their faces. And some people I don't even talk to because they're not ready to talk. Other people I talk to because they want to talk, because that's a part of the therapeutic healing process for themselves. So depending on who people are, the kinds of resources that they've been able to access, if they've been able to access some sort of support, and whether that trauma is something in the past or whether the trauma is ongoing, because where they are, they face new forms of racism and discrimination or legal precarity or economic precarity. For some people, the trauma isn't something in the past they have to deal with, but every new day, new challenge compounds that with new forms of suffering.
Even in the more stable years of the Assad family regime, there was this authoritarian rule. And as you say, the sense that the government or the folks in power were kind of always watching. And you have some remarkable quotes about that mm-hmm. that you've use in your books and in your talk. And just wonder if you could talk a little bit about how the folks that you talked to expressed that and showed like maybe this worry that almost down to any level of their lives, they were worried about saying the wrong thing and the consequences of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a place where politics was totally forbidden, where you might have some space to find work and feed your family, but to engage in any way, offer an opinion about those in power. And those in power could abuse it endlessly because there was no rule of law, no accountability, favoritism, corruption, nepotism, a security rule. So if you were in any way critical of the political system and those in power and vocalize that, you could be picked up, thrown in prison, and never seen again. And people often would say to me things like, you wished you would be killed rather than thrown into prison, because being thrown in prison was a slow, torturous death of tremendous suffering and starvation and beatings and everything you could imagine. So that hovered, and there was a fear. You know, people always use the expression, the walls have ears. Be afraid of what you say because you are being watched. Anybody could write a report on you to the police and then you would be arrested. And you could even have a report written about you on totally false, trumped up charges. The stories are legendary about people who were arrested and they had no involvement in politics whatsoever. But this was what can happen, a system in where there's zero accountability and those who have power can abuse it without limits, and those who don't have power have total vulnerability and very little that they can do to protect themselves.
Talking about that and just talking about the refugees you interviewed in general, is there a wide spectrum of maybe the means they had, the socioeconomic means that they would have to leave a bad situation? Some are forced to leave a situation due to, I mean, there's bombs falling every day for safety. And they might not have more than the clothes on their backs when they leave. But others, and we've seen this in the history of Europe and throughout, you know, different history, might have had the means and might say, listen, I don't feel safe here. We can move somewhere else. Did you find a diversity of that in the Syrian refugees that you spoke to?
Absolutely. And I myself made two visits to Syria in the past year after the Assad regime fell, and talked to some people who were internally displaced but were never managed to become refugees outside the country. And I remember asking a woman, did you ever think of leaving? And she said, absolutely, but we couldn't afford to. I didn't have the money to pay a taxi to take myself to the Turkish border. There's a wonderful article by a refugee studies scholar in the UK who has an article that said, I went as far as my money could take me. And that tells you, I think, a lot about displacement, that there are people who were not simply able to leave Syria because they didn't have the money to bribe people at checkpoints, to pay smugglers, to pay taxis and so forth, and even to get themselves on the border. And then there were people who lived in predominantly Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan close to the border because they might not have been able to afford to move to larger towns further away. And then there were those who weren't able to piece together the money to pay for boats and smugglers to try to make it to Europe. So what resources you have absolutely determines if you can get out and how far you can go and what kinds of opportunities you have once you're there. And there are people I've met who went into enormous debt to be able to become displaced.
That leads into the places that refugees can make it to, where they go, whether they're choosing to go there or not, and the situations they find themselves here in these other countries. I mean, this has created, and other situations have created, a series of crises in this region. Did you talk to any folks that thought that they were seeking safe haven only to find themselves in a situation where, due to whatever reasons, political pushback, racism, anti-immigration sentiment, that made them even, I've gone from one bad situation to a different bad situation?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the most important words of the Syrian uprising is dignity. And it was kind of a rallying cry throughout the Arab uprisings, and probably an important theme for people who migrate from all sorts of situations of searching for basic dignity, where you have rights, where you have opportunity, where you can be a full human being with respect and be who you want to be. And many who flee because they are facing situations that undercut their dignity arrive in situations that undercut their dignity in different ways. through exactly the reasons you said, to discrimination, to racism, to poverty, to legal persecution or lack of rights. So absolutely across the years, I talked to people who said, I was escaping one type of suffering and here I have another. And in fact, I was just in Turkey last year talking to some young people about whether or not they wanted to return to Syria, and talked to several high school, college age young Syrians who were preparing to return to Syria, in part because of the bullying that they've experienced in schools in Turkey. And to think, I mean, bullying is such a horrible phenomenon that we have in the United States and other places, but that it would bring someone to make these huge life decisions, like moving from one country to another, makes you stop and think, my goodness, how cruel we can be to each other. That for some, being that kind of cruelty as a kind of sport for fun and literally could drive a person, especially someone from a situation where there might be relative physical security, a relative economic security, to a place where there's less physical security and less economic security, because they won't tolerate those threats to their basic human dignity of living in a situation of respect, makes you think, okay, wars and complicated political situations often require difficult solutions, and resolving poverty and creating economic equality are really big things to try to fix. But the capacity of every individual to treat another person with decency is something that every single individual can decide to do or not to do. And that's one thing that every single person can do to make the world more accepting and more fair for everyone.
So one of the concepts that you talk about in interview your subjects, these hundreds of folks, about is the concept of home. Home, by definition, I guess, is the place where they were that they had to flee from. And, you know, as you say, people move into different situations. Some relocated and start a new life somewhere else, you know, everywhere, you know, be other in Europe and throughout the Middle East, come to the United States. How often in the folks you talked about, did it take for them to understand or to come up with an idea? Or did they even get the idea that a new place they are, where they've established a life, is home? Or do they still think, well, this isn't the same. This isn't because I was forced to do this. This isn't my home.
Yeah, there's such a beautiful diversity of experiences of home. I definitely talk to people who, and maybe it's not even a function of time. I mean, time might help or might affect things, but I talk to people who said, no matter what, I'm still going to see that place that I left as home, because there are these memories of childhood innocence, of community, of a cultural celebration, of where the family was home, whole and together, that will always seem like home. And then there were other people I talked to who said, that place where I came from, I was persecuted and I was treated with violence and with cruelty and with lack of rights. What home was that? I wasn't treated like a human being. Now in this new place, maybe I have more rights and more opportunity, and this is more of a home than that ever was, because that home pushed me out, or that even my own home government tortured me or dropped bombs on my house. And then there are other people who say home isn't even a place. It's not there or it's not here. Home is my family, or home is wherever I can thrive and flourish. Home is a feeling of freedom or a feeling of dignity. Home is any place that gives me the space to be who I want to be and find a sense of purpose. So that was one of the things that really most surprised me in the work, because I think I also came to it thinking of home as a place. Is it there or is it here? And when does it become there? And when is it here? And when does it stop being there and start being here? And people who were between places often thought of home in a way that was almost untethered from land or space or a map, and thought about home in really creative ways that really inspired me to think about home as a feeling or as an experience or as human relations that might have a place component, but could also go beyond it.
Going back a little bit to what you were mentioning about the individual approach of bestowing dignity upon individuals, in the past 10 years or so, there has been a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment building in Europe, the United States. Yet it's interesting, because I don't think anybody wants to be a refugee. These are all individuals and groups of people that are reacting to something that's happening in the place they are. And sometimes those things that are happening are related to foreign policy and efforts that are either supported either tacitly or actively by governments, some of the same governments that have the anti-immigration sentiment rising. Why do you think, and this is a big question, why do you think it is that it is so hard to tie one concept to the other, that this very thing that is stressing the economics of your country, that is creating a need for resources to deal with an influx of immigrants or refugees, ties back to actions that were made in those places by the support of powerful governments?
Yeah. You know, most Syrians I would talk to were absolutely making those connections. So they would say things like, well, if you don't want us here in your country, stop making war on our country or do something to help. That there was a time when there were so many different countries that were involved in the war in Syria and had planes in the air or boots on the ground or were funding one group or another that made life unlivable, that literally forced people to leave. And people said, fine, if you don't want us here, we don't want to be here either. We want to stay in our own countries, either stop contributing to war or do something positive to help resolve the war, and we'll all go back in a heartbeat. But it's a terrific question of why many of us who are not living that reality can't connect the dots. And I think it's, frankly, just a ignorance of not understanding and a bit of privilege of not being forced to understand. I think, you know, for us in the United States, we have the globe's most powerful military involved in all sorts of conflicts, but they're far away. It's easy to ignore it. It's on the other side of oceans or miles and miles away, and we are often not forced to even know what our own country and our own tax dollars are involved in doing, no less actively take responsibility as citizens and taxpayers for it, and connect the dots, especially in this rising anti-immigrant, xenophobic context, to say, what responsibility does each one of us and our country play in creating a situation that forced other people around the world to flee their homes? I wish more people would connect the dots and then draw the ethical consequences of what that means, both for changing a foreign policy so that it does less damage in the world, and for sure confronting this anti-migrant feeling for what it is, which is often just sheer racism, hatred of others. And it's a sorry judgment about where so many in our country are.
So one final thing. At the time we're recording this, April of 2026, hundreds of thousands in Lebanon have been displaced by what's happening there. And interestingly, many of them are fleeing into Syria. Some of them were Syrians that fled Syria and went to Lebanon. I wonder if you can reflect on how this is a continuation of this Syrian refugee story.
Yeah. I mean, what you had said earlier, this kind of chain of events from authoritarianism to an uprising to war and chemical weapons attack and interventions and barrel bombs and sieges and then earthquake. And now for the some million Syrians in Lebanon, that this horror of the current massive bombardment on Lebanon and displacement crisis is for Syrians in Lebanon, and as well as the small numbers of Lebanese who cross the border into Syria, just another stage. It reminds us that displacement is ongoing as we speak. There are also millions of Iranians who've been displaced, and none of this is a far gone, historic, long ago finished phenomena. It is literally ongoing as we speak. Some 1 in 5 people in Lebanon are displaced as we record this right now, and the United States is playing a role in that displacement. We have to confront that reality, and I would hope do whatever we can to stop it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this today in this podcast, and then for speaking with our students and the others who were present at your talk, Voices of Refugees. Dr. Perlman, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Wendy Perlman is the Jane Long Professor of Arts and Sciences and a Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University. She is the author of several books, including We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria. She joined us today after her talk, Voices of Refugees, at Heartland Community College. If you're interested in other interviews about current events, history, or other topics, subscribe to Random Acts of Knowledge on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you found this one. Thanks for listening.